Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 1st, 2005. This session, Muslim Women Finding Voices, presented in the Fireside Room by Nellie Van Dorn Harder. Disc number VAN-2005-05. Let's listen in.
If you hear me, I don't know, it's so strange, you know. You have to talk into the dark. So we are speaking about women in Islam, and I think I called it something like finding their own voice, to show that it is not just only, pacified, subordinated, and so forth, women who are silent. But before we start, I want to ask you, when I say women in Islam, what comes up in your mind? What do you think about? What kind of pictures do you think about?
Oppression.
Oppression, okay. The other class called it subordination. So that, shall I write the subordination down? Because
yeah,
there were some other S words. Mm-hmm. Oppression or subordination, and we'll come back to that. What other? Do you want a seat? Do you want to join us?
I will join.
Oh, there are seats. Okay, you're okay. Okay.
Underprivileged.
Underprivileged. Yeah. Yeah. You were first, and then you, and then you. And I haven't even looked at this site yet, but it calls up a lot of connotations, obviously, right?
Mystery. Yeah.
Mystery. Okay.
Veiled.
The chador, hidden in the black chador.
Okay. Mystery, veiled, and the chador is the... Do we all know what the chador is?
No.
Yeah? Who has never heard of the word chador? Okay. The chador is the heaviest veil. It's the one where you only have a little window to look through. That's also covered. So you bump into people and things because you can't really look. You can't drive a car when you wear that. That's a chador. Okay, yeah.
Property.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. We maybe put that here. And if you can later on tell me what you mean with that. Yeah? Yeah? We come back to that.
A paradox. I heard on radio women in the chador talking about going to Victoria's Secret to get the special treat for their man.
Right. So the paradox. Yeah. Perfect. Absolutely great. Yeah.
Segregation.
Yeah, that's why I wrote subordination. Then we have two S words. Then we can segregation. We can more easily remember them. Yeah. Segregation.
Courageous.
Courageous. Right, that's
totally
a good
different.
That's a good one too.
Courageous.
No, but it is a good one and a very important one. Courageous. You remember it was an Iranian Muslim woman who got the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One
that I was thinking. Right. Anything else? Yeah?
Honor killing.
Ooh, yes. Honor killing. That goes with property.
Mm-hmm.
Have we all heard of honor killings?
Mm-hmm.
Who has not heard of it? Who has not heard of honor killings?
Could you remind us?
You have not heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll explain it, okay? And if I don't, remind me.
Parental rights they don't have.
Parental rights that falls into property and honor killings. Very good one. Okay, now let us now start with a story about Muslim women, because we see we have a very negative vision here of Muslim women and their position, and you wonder why would anybody want to convert to Islam, right? And we have very few, we have only one positive remark here. And thanks for bringing that in, because it's very important. And if we now think of what has been in the news lately, the last year, I think about Spain. There was a court case in Spain of a leader of a mosque, an imam, who had written a handbook. Anybody of you heard about it? He had written a handbook, and that's why he was brought to court on how to beat your wife without leaving prints, marks, without show that nobody would see it. So it was where to beat her and how to beat her. So that didn't go down well in Spanish society, And he was then, his sentence was that he had 1 year of probation, and if he would ever do something like that again, he would go to jail. And so, that the wife beating goes here. I'm going to talk about that later. So that was very negative. But on the other hand, 18th of March this year, there was another piece of news that blew away the world. Any of you happens to know what it was? Someone called Amina Wadud was involved. You know? Have you heard about it?
Was she the Nobel Peace Prize?
No. She was in New York. Amina Wadud is an African-American Muslim. She's actually the daughter of a Methodist pastor. And she became Muslim like 40 years ago or something, or 30-something years ago. She decided to break one of the most stringent rules in Islam. The rule is that a community of men and women who prays together should only be led by men. Women praying should actually also only be led by men, but in certain cases women can be led by prayers. But a woman is never allowed to lead mixed prayer. And that's what she did. And the whole Arab world especially was upside down, was on its head. And in flew the fatwas, fatwa is a legal advice or religious advice, in flew there, especially from Saudi Arabia, with that this was an absolutely abhorring event, horrible, and that this was forbidden, and that they didn't say so, but of course they thought Amina Wadud was surely on her straightway to hell, and so forth and so forth. Well, what was Amina Wadud's reaction? This is very interesting. Amina Wadud is a Muslim, and she is a very devout, practicing Muslim. She wears the veil, and she has written a book over 20 years ago where she has reinterpreted the Quran herself. She has read the Quran and said, what do I read in the Quran? And I'll come back to that. So she knows her stuff, right? And she said, I am an African-American Muslim. I am a US citizen. This is my Islam. And I have no business with all kinds of sheikhs in Saudi Arabia. They are Saudi. I am not. And so this is a very interesting symptom of what is happening in the Muslim world. Because what we are seeing is a huge struggle. And we've been talking about that all week last week. There is a huge struggle going on in the Muslim world, right? And the struggle is about who can interpret the Quran? Who defines what it is to be a good Muslim? And who defines what women can and cannot do? And she just broke through that, but by doing that, in a way, she voiced the sentiments of many Muslim women who are not in a position yet to air this kind of opinion. She can do it because she is protected by our freedom of speech system, and she is protected by our general system of freedom, right, of religion, and so forth and so forth. So she could do that here. But one thing we have to always realize is that a lot of Muslims, men and women, live in countries where you do not have much freedom. And when you go beyond the paradigm that is accepted, publicly accepted, you have to be very careful or you might end up in jail. So that is something we always have to keep in mind when we think about Muslims. But if we now think about Muslim extremists, we all know them. I hate the word fundamentalist, but you know what I'm talking about, right? But it's not a good word, isn't it? Because in many ways we're all fundamentalists. We all take the Bible seriously, don't we? Mm-hmm. But so there's many ways. People say Islamists, fundamentalists, neo-fundamentalists, most extremists. But let's think about people who basically want to purify Islam, who want to go back to the ideal days when the Prophet Muhammad was still on earth, and who want to change the world according to their vision. Do you know who I'm talking about? Yeah? Who am I talking about? Can anybody give an example of those people or where they operate?
Jihadists.
What?
Jihadis.
Terrorists,
right? Think about countries. Where did they get the power?
Afghanistan,
right. That's a very good example. Any other countries?
Pakistan.
They're trying very hard. Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia.
At one point in...
The Wahhabi?
What?
I can't think of the Wahhabi.
Wahhabi.
The Wahhabis, right?
Iran.
What?
Iran.
Iran, right. And at one point they had the power in Sudan, where they introduced Islamic law. They're trying very hard in the north of Nigeria. Very hard to get their power. Now, what is the symbol? What is the symbol and the first sign that they succeed? What do you see change in the streets, you think?
The women are dressed.
The women are dressed according to a certain code. So the women are really the central issue in this whole battle of who is preaching the right form of Islam. And you see that, for example, think about the country as Egypt, where I used to live. In the 80s, women were half veiled, half not. And, you know, there is also quite a substantial Christian community in Egypt, so you couldn't quite tell the difference here and there. But, you know, there was a kind of relaxation. People would, for example, wear a long dress and then just a cap on their head or a hat to cover their hair, okay? But then extremist elements started to emerge in society and started to apply their program. And the first thing they did is force women in their family to wear an outfit that, according to them, was properly Islamic, which is like, they look like nuns, basically. You know, that you can't see the difference between a classical garb of a nun, very long, and then a skull cap and over it a long veil. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
And that kind of outfit, and it tends to be black or gray or dark gray, tones of gray, you know, no happy colors there. Mm-hmm. That was what was the true Islamic outfit. So first the sisters, then the mothers, and then the cousins. And so, you know, they started to put peer pressure, a pressure on the people around them, but always the women first. Because what are the men gonna wear? You know, what are they gonna wear? They know not everybody's gonna wear a skirt in the name of Islam. Lots of men wear jeans and they won't give that up. So the women are a much easier target. Mm-hmm. So you see their body, their appearance, controlling them and applying the proper rules to the women is the key of grabbing what?
The power.
The power. Because ultimately it is about power. It's about political power through religion, and if you have the political power, you have the money, right? That is what it is about. Ultimately, it doesn't really have that much to do with religion, which often we do not realize. It is a power game that is going on in many countries. Nigeria, the north and the south, Nigeria is the third producing oil country, right?
That's correct.
If you have the power in Nigeria, you're sitting on a pot of gold, or not?
It's true.
Yeah. So you see what I mean? There's much more going on than just Islam and purifying Islam. There's much more going on, and tomorrow I'm going to talk about where those reactions and anti-reactions against, you know, what they felt as the weakening of Islam, where that comes from and how that was expressed. So if we think about women, now I'm having to look at my stuff here, yeah? Got it? Then we have to keep that in mind. They are a poem. They are a symbol of a much wider battle. And then in a roundabout way, women themselves, you know, will start to feel part of that battle. Beginning of the Iranian Revolution. Remember how many women were pro and were fighting for an Islamic State until they realized what it meant in reality. Then they didn't like it that much anymore. So that is what is happening in many, many countries. And you have also, for example, one thing that we have to keep in mind when you are in the West. You have reactions from Muslims living here who become, you know, more Muslim than they would ever be in their own country. That's what we have. That's what Muslims moving to Europe. Muslims, you must have seen them in Europe. Muslims moving to the States, you know. You have to suddenly decide, who am I? How am I practicing my faith? And so you suddenly start to enlarge that Muslim identity, and it all goes back to individualism. You, as the individual, suddenly have to decide. There's no more country that decides for you. There's no mosque that decides for you. You are free to decide. You see? So you become, what we say, more Catholic than the Pope. That's what, I don't know, do you say that in English too? Yeah, that's what you become. So that is that's another stream we're seeing. We're seeing that here. And this morning someone said she had met a girl who was heavily veiled and said, I have to be heavily veiled to be protected against man, and otherwise I'm a sex object. Well, I don't think that the rate of, you know, sexual harassment has gone up or down dramatically since women started to veil in the Middle East. It's been always the same, you know. But it's, as I say, it's a roundabout justification, an after-the-fact justification of what you are actually doing. So, did I make my point clear so far? Because now we're going to look at where this comes from. Now, if we think about Islam, it's very important to keep in mind four words. The first one is the Quran. We all know the Quran, right? Mm-hmm. The second one is the tradition. The third one is the interpretation. And the fourth one is the Islamic law or the Sharia that is based on these three. It's very important. Now, with the Quran, we all know it's holy. We all know that, do you all know that, by the way? The Quran mm-hmm. is so holy that if you just quote any random verse, people already are in awe. If you quote any random verse in Arabic, they will immediately think you're a Muslim. And if they don't know the Quran very well and your pronunciation is beautiful, they have deep respect for the words. Because the Quran by itself is considered powerful enough to just change everything, to purify everything. Why? Because Muslims believe that it was sent down from heaven, directly codified in a book, and that is what they have today. Never mind that that's not true. Never mind it was codified after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. Lots of pieces were thrown away or burned or destroyed. Other pieces were hidden. Never mind. The idea every Muslim is raised to know there's only one Quran, one text straight from God, and that's the truth, because that Quran corrects what the Jews were sent and what the Christians were sent. So we are following a book that's falsified. Yeah? But because it is the direct word of God, it is considered so holy that just holding up the Quran is enough to impress people. Yeah? Do I make sense? Does it make sense to you? Okay.
We have a lot of Christians that feel the same way.
Right.
So
about the Bible.
Yeah,
but we do know that there was a process of the formation, and that there are books that didn't make it into the Bible. Are you saying that Christians are going to accept
that? I'm talking about some of your real evangelicals.
Right.
Hold it up and it's yada.
Right. Well, think about that model and then the whole Muslim world. Mm-hmm. Okay? Most Muslims will say, oh, you know, and whenever I followed the Quran lesson in Indonesia, you took turns reading something, so then I read my part, and they all assumed for years that I was a Muslim. It never occurred to them, they never saw me pray or something, but they just assumed, and I didn't say anything, so that was it. Anyway, it did not occur to me that they assumed that. That's why I didn't say anything. I didn't think I should. I just assumed I was teaching at a Christian place. I assumed they knew I was a Christian, right? I sometimes even mentioned going to church. So, but no, I knew Arabic. That overruled everything. So you see, it's very, very, in the mind, this is what happens. Anyway, what we now have to keep in mind is this. There are things in the Quran that are taken very seriously. There are things in the Quran that are only known through the interpretation. There are things in the Quran lots of Muslims ignore, very much like the Bible. Very much like the Bible, you know. If people say, no, it's in the Quran, you should never say, what does the Quran say? You should ask, what do Muslims say the Quran says? And then you will get 100 answers. You quote the verse and you might get 100 answers, just like our denominations and different individual interpretations. You see? But, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow, the idea of extremists is to make it all one interpretation. And of course, even that doesn't work. But we come back to that another time. Why is this so important? Because if you now look at women, everything that concerns women most, such as the rules about marriage, right? And the rules about divorce, and the rules about custody, and the rules about who owes you, who owns you really, right? Where do they come from? Where do they come from? Do they all come from the Quran? No. No. There's actually very little in the Quran. Is the wife beating in the Quran? Yes. It is. And for those of you who want to know, it's in chapter 4, verse 34. There it says that you can beat your wife if she's not obedient. First you have to admonish her, then you have to strike her lightly, then you can beat her. It doesn't say how hard you can beat her. It says you can beat her. Right? Anyway. And the fourth step is you can refuse to sleep with her. So there's a gradation in chastising and correcting your wife. Yeah. Okay. Sorry if I gave you wrong ideas. I would say, okay, let him beat me and then stay away from me. But if you are an abuser, if I can make him get you to do that, okay. But that's my logic. Anyway, so that is in the Quran. Beating is, yes, it is in the Quran. And of course, it's a huge issue in the 21st century. Because who still allows beating of children, of women? Who allows it? Do we allow it? Does anybody here think it's okay?
No.
Well, most Muslims will have the same reaction. Most Muslims also live in the 21st century, you see. So they struggle with this verse. What does this beating mean? So we need reinterpretation. But the thing is this. First of all, there is the tradition. That's everything the Prophet said and did. Everything he said and did and what he thought is in there too. Right? And that is considered almost holy because there's a lot that's not in the Quran. So a lot of what concerns women comes from the tradition. And when if we talk about segregation, we didn't talk about the mosque. If you think about the mosque, has any of you ever seen how Muslims pray in a mosque?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, men in front, women in the back, right? Now, where does segregation come from? It comes from different sources. One is that from the tradition that the Prophet at one point said that it is better for women to pray at home. And some Muslims take that very seriously. This morning I gave the example of a mosque I visited just in May in Amsterdam, of all places. It was built by a Pakistani, Indian, Suriname community. It could hold almost 3,000 men. And I was a bit puzzled. I said, where's the quarter for women? There are none. There was not one room for women. They just assumed that women would never come. This is the 21st century in Amsterdam. Muslims living in Amsterdam. Now, what is interesting is this. Would they get away with it in India or in Pakistan to build such a mosque? Never. Never. Because you have here people like Rifat Hassan, who is a female professor of Islamic studies from Pakistan, but teaching in the States. She would immediately jump up and come on TV and say, how dare they? How dare they leave the women out? But you know, in Amsterdam, I don't think it even occurred to people that they were building a mosque where there was no space for women. So you see, there's this first thing. Segregation comes from the ritual obligations, comes from the praying together, and it comes from the fact that women are not always considered pure because they menstruate. So when you are considered impure, you're not allowed to participate in the rituals. Think about it. You spend five months on the ship to make the pilgrimage in Mecca, and suddenly you have your period. That was terrible in the old days. But then you could not do it. You could not. And you had to come back. So that's why people did it at an older age, you see. Now, just to give you a sense of what's happening with being pure, yeah?
I wondered if we see the radical Islam in Europe, if it's because there are more male immigrants.
Yeah.
And they just are there without their women. Is
yes,
is that true or is that not true?
Not, no longer, no. Like that mosque I saw, all these people had family reunion. All of them had doors. And you know what? The caretaker of the mosque, who of all people had designed the thing, was telling me proudly how one of his doctors was a pharmacist, one was a dentist, and the other was a medical doctor.
His daughters?
His daughters! And I said, don't they want to go to the mosque? And he was just flabbergasted. He said, I had never thought about that. So it is just the mindset that somehow has developed. And as I say, people just let them develop. He's sitting there in Amsterdam and nobody was, you know, challenging him in one way or the other. So that's one thing. If we think about the segregation, but the other part of the segregation comes from the Quran. So I'm going now through these points to show you how the Quran comes in there. In the Quran it says, at one point, that there should be a curtain between the wives of the Prophet and the community. That is where segregation comes from. Segregation never said men and women should be separate. That is which culture?
Arabic.
Arab Bedouin culture. That is Arab Bedouin culture. It's not in the Quran. In the Quran it just said like, oops, this Prophet is becoming so important and so well known, and there come men and they can see his wives, and by the time he had 9, they had a lot to watch. So people said that is inappropriate for a prophet. You can't do that. A prophet is someone higher. So we should make a curtain, and the wife should stay behind the curtain, and when they are in the mosque they should pray behind that curtain. You see what I mean? And from there, that linked up with the big C word of culture. So Quran and culture met because there was a segregation in society, but as Islam spread, there was also segregation in Christian places like Syria and Jordan. There was segregation there too. So segregation for almost 1,300 years became part of Islamic practice. It was just assumed that it was part of Islam, right? And that is why you see it mostly in the Middle East, and then you see it in Pakistan and India, and you see it mostly in countries where people can afford to segregate. Because what does segregation mean? That women have no public role. Women cannot be visible in public, and Saudi Arabia right now is the only place where they can still pull that off, right? That's really the only place. The rest of the Muslim countries, women are now in all kinds of public places and they're active and they're working and so forth. So that is a segregation issue. It comes partly from the mosque because of the wives of the Prophet. It becomes partly from culture. And then it grew into something that was assumed to be Islamic, but actually was not. You see? Now, if we then go to the veil, where does the veil come from? Who knows what's in the Quran, actually, about the veil? Does it say you have to veil yourself?
It just says be modest.
It says be modest and cover your shame. Now, what is your shame? Nobody knows. Cover your shame. What part of your body is that? You know, does it mean you can wear shorts or not? So again, what you see is the referring to early Arabic culture, early Middle Eastern culture, which is you cover your shame very much like the Virgin Mary was dressed, right? Because she was dressed with a long veil and a long robe and so forth and so forth. So that the veil is not in the Quran necessarily, and that is why there's such a battle going on about the veil, because there are women who say, I don't find it. If I veil, it's my choice, but I can also not veil, you see? So there is, again, there is, and the more educated people become, the more they can read themselves what's in there. And the more they can read themselves what kind of interpretations were made. Now going back to the interpretations, this is something you always should remember. Who were the first interpreters? Do you remember from last week?
Men.
Huh? Men from Arabia?
Saudi Arabia.
Mostly from villages. Because there were no big cities, remember? So they were very insulated people. People who were sitting there trying to interpret the words of the Prophet and the words of the Quran. Then, as Islam spread, who were the new interpreters? Many, many converts. Converts, especially from Judaism. and from Christianity. And from the converts from Judaism then helped build the law system. And that is why Islamic law so much looks like Jewish law. Because it were converts from Judaism who laid out those patterns, because these people from those villages had no clue. They didn't know. But there they were. They had the Quran, they had the words of the Prophet. They somehow had to apply them to reality. How do you do that? Well, there was sometimes a headache. And that is how we come to the property issue. Because during the life of the Prophet, somehow there had been revelations about marriage, that a man should properly marry a woman and take care of her. And that, in a way, was problematic too, because that same verse 4:34 that talks about beating also says that men are the protectors of women. And a lot of people then took that protectors to mean they are the rulers of women, over women, they are the boss, right? But what is not in the Quran is a contract. What is not in the Quran is what should a marriage look like and what type of contract do you use? That's nowhere. And the Prophet didn't talk about it either. So what do you think they took as reference? You maybe know it already, so don't say. Who has a clue of what contracts they took as reference that did exist?
Something from tradition.
Something from tradition? What did they have in those days that you bought and sold, human beings?
Slaves.
They took the slave contracts as the model for the marriage contract. Yeah. Now, does that explain something or not?
Yes.
This explains the whole package. It explains the property idea. It explains the honor killings, and I'll get back to what those are. It explains the subordination. Because what you do, actually, is you buy a woman from her father. She is the property of her father. You buy her, and actually, sorry to say, you buy the right to sleep with her. That's what you buy. Because you can also, you could still buy a slave, remember, who would cook for you. So you buy a wife from her father, and then you have the rules you have for slavery, which is, a slave could not just say, I feel like making a stroll in Holden Village. No, the slave had to ask permission to go anywhere, right? So a wife has to ask permission from her husband if she wants to go out, according to the Islamic law. Then a slave was not free to move back to parents. A wife is not free to move back to parents. A slave was, of course, never free to run away. That is why, have you ever heard of those rules where the police is sent at women who run away from the husband? Has any of you ever heard of those cases? Mm-hmm. That's why. In some countries, for example, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Pakistan, the police can come and bring you home. And let me tell you something. How we know this is culture. A Christian woman in Egypt can be brought home by the police too. Yeah. Because for very different reasons, but it has become so much ingrained in the culture that that's what the police does. They bring the women home. And you cannot leave the country. And there was this famous case of a cabinet minister, a member of the cabinet. She had to travel abroad. She had a beef with her husband. He took her passport and said she can't travel. That was it. So the international delegation had to miss their minister. That can happen. That can happen. Anyway, so you see where this comes from. And so hence the honor killing. The honor killing is when your property, like your unmarried daughter or your married wife, links up with someone she should not link up with. Have an affair, have a boyfriend, right? Choose a boyfriend. Then the family in some countries feels entitled to kill you, like they would have felt entitled to kill a slave. Because that person is no longer, well, it's a damaged good. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Even holding hands with someone makes you a damaged good. You know, I'm not talking about sleeping together, I'm talking about holding hands, maybe staring at each other, maybe even a kiss, damaged. And in many countries, that is how how that is being considered. And so then some families feel they are entitled to kill that person because she's worthless. She's worthless. You can't sell her to anybody anymore. Nobody will ever marry her anymore. Or if she's very lucky, they will marry her off to an old, ugly guy somewhere far away.
What about the case of rape?
What?
What about the case of rape?
Case of rape is very complicated. Again, this is sociology, this is culture, this is not religion. What I know from rape, you know, when I worked in Egypt, I was in charge of a refugee agency. What I know from rape is that the woman is always blamed. Mm-hmm. And I was involved, and please don't go to Egypt and tell this, I was involved in cases where a cousin had raped a girl. She had become pregnant. And then there was a very complicated system to get her out of the village, transport her to Cairo, tell the family she's going to do a sewing course or some other vocational something. And then she was put in a clinic till it was time to deliver the baby. And then she was repaired and sent back. And nobody would ever know she had a child. And at the same time, another woman would start to wear pillows to look pregnant. Oh, wow. And when the baby came, the baby would go to that woman. Oh. Because there is no adoption officially in the Muslim world. According to Islamic law, adoption is forbidden. So that is how you had to do it. Otherwise, you would find her dead in the Nile. That was what happened. But again, this is culture. In Indonesia, this never happened. I've never heard of honor killings in Indonesia. I know several people who had extramarital children in Indonesia. Well, they just disappear in the family. They're just there and nobody ever mentions. You just don't mention. It's taboo to mention where the kid comes from and who really the mother is. It's just there. So that's what I say. It's Middle Eastern culture. Yeah?
So the entitlement that these parents and brothers they feel, is that not duty bound on them by their religion? I mean, are there some religious leaders that preach that entitlement?
Absolutely. Thanks for adding that. Because then what you have the psychology of the man, of course, who feel it is their duty to protect, whatever that means. Right. Right. Absolutely. Thanks for adding that. Because, and then, of course, that plays a huge role in sermons. And there's something else. Until about 20 years ago, a lot of sermons in places like Egypt and Jordan were sermons recycled from the 12th, 13th century. Because their Arabic was so beautiful, people would learn them by heart and just say them. I don't think they understood themselves what they were saying, neither was their audience. But you see, it means that you deliver a package that was written up 700 years ago. And that is what the people take as reality, so to speak. So there is this mix of culture and of religion. And as I say, some is in the Quran, some is in the tradition, some is in the interpretation, and the interpretation is very, very heavily influenced by the culture. Yeah? Do I make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
Do not lose hope, however. I know Dorothy says, you always sound so hopeless, right? Do not lose hope, because hope is coming in a minute. But we understand where the system comes from, right? But the paradox is very important, and I think we should almost put the paradox with courageous. Because inside the system there are so many paradoxes. You know, because people are people. And when you go to any Muslim country, or if you know any Muslim, you know they're no different from us. And the educational level of both men and women in many countries is improving. And the moment you have a generation that has high school, things changed. The moment you have a generation that has a lot of people who have college education, things change. And that is what we are now seeing in the Muslim world. Hence, the battle is intensifying. Because now you get all these university-educated women who say, well, now let me see what is in the Quran, really. Like as what happened to us, right? Mm-hmm. We have a female scholar of Jewish text here, right? Yeah, you are going to speak this afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope I can come. I look very much forward to it. And we have Christian theologians, women, who have studied our texts. And they have interpreted and said, now, how do we read this in a women-friendly way? And that's what's happening in the Middle East and in the Far East and all over the Muslim world as well. But it can, of course, happen more in places where you have the freedom, like Europe and the United States, and so far, place like Indonesia, and even in Nigeria.
Yes.
Even in Nigeria. What's her name again? Aisha?
Roland.
What?
Roland.
Roland?
Right.
Yeah? And there is another woman, I forgot her name right now. Aisha, I forgot. Her sister, of all places, works in Valparaiso University. I forgot to say, I think, that I teach there, right? That's where I teach, in Indiana. Her sister works there. I mean, she is a human rights, women rights activist in Nigeria, and she just received a very important award in New York. And so, all over the Muslim world, you have these voices rising. Yeah?
Who is the woman that the Islam from Canada, I think? She was just on TV again last week. A very vocal...
is she the...
She says she really isn't even a Muslim anymore.
Yeah.
Who is this?
I know who you mean. Anybody remembers the name? I know who you mean. She's lesbian?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And she, I heard her art discussed last week. She's
So
articulate.
Yeah,
so
I know. Yeah, but the thing is this. She has no impact on Muslims.
Yeah.
They hate her. Because she says, I'm actually not a Muslim. Mm. So if you want to change, you have to do like Luther. From the inside. There is no other way. You have to stay in the system and from the inside slowly change it. And from the inside slowly push the borders and create new possibilities and opportunities. And that is what is happening really all over the Muslim world. Yeah.
You know, I want to believe what you're saying. I agree with you that, you know, I tend to think that a lot of the problems in Islam is the repression of the women, that we need the women to contribute to society, we need that input, we need that insight, everything the women have. But at the same time, you're constantly reading how the terrorists are, for the most part, middle class, highly educated, have traveled internationally.
Yeah.
I was reading about Atta, one of the main guys who was an architect, an urban planner, very organized, very highly educated, yet an extremist.
But he hated women, remember? He didn't want to be buried with them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yet that education
and
Western education did nothing to change
did
his
nothing,
mindset.
Did nothing. You're right. You're so right. But I'm not only talking about women. I'm talking about that the level of education is changing things. And people like Atta don't like that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like that. That's why they fight against it. That's why we have this fierce battle going on. And the battle of the extremists who blow themselves up has many layers, right? It is against the West. It is also internally, because, you know, they kill far more Muslims than they kill non-Muslims. We keep forgetting that. And they try to, they want a pure Islam that will reign all over the world. How that looks like, nobody knows. It's really all in the head. It's really a fiction of their imagination. But that is what they're after. And it is very complex why they do what they do. But at the same time, there are a lot of women in Morocco, in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Jordan, in Syria, in Indonesia, Malaysia, here in the States, also in Canada, but not the one we were referring to, in Europe, who are starting to take hold of this bulwark, because this is a bulwark that was shaped by, let's say, the 9th century, 9th, 10th century, it was shaped and set in stone, and only man had access to this. Only man studied this. And only men would go to the madrasas, because the madrasa, we've all heard about the famous madrasas, right? The madrasas were like boarding schools. Well, with this system of property, right, you cannot send your girl to a boarding school. You don't do that. So girls would stay at home and the boys would go to the madrasa and learn everything you need to be a scholar of Islam or a preacher. Now, what the big change now is that women can have access to this system, because they are starting to learn. They are starting, you know, they first learn to read and write. Most of the women, I think 30 years ago in a place like Egypt, 80% of the women was illiterate. Now those numbers are changing. And some then start to read the Holy Scriptures and the explanation of the Holy Scriptures and start to punch holes in the reasonings. You see what I mean? But people like Atta, it's again, it's very much like we in our own Christianity. We have people who want to blow up to get what they want, who feel that that's what God wants, and they want to set the world straight according to their interpretation of the mind of God. And you have people who say, no, there are many more ways to interpret this text. I think that in every religion, we have this whole spectrum of individuals. Of some, I think, like Atta, what I think eventually is that he was power sick and he wanted a shortcut to paradise. And you know, of course, what the virgins, they are in the Quran, but you know what the word actually is thought to mean, the huris.
The what?
The huris. In the Quran it says that in paradise man will know that a man, yeah, will get huris. And it is a Syriac word, and those of you who were here last week, what was it again, the huris?
Well, the traditional interpretation has been virgins.
Virgins.
But it's raisins.
Yeah. Now, new scholarship has dug up that it's our raisins. So I imagine Atta being extreme, he sits there with a bowl of raisins if he's in paradise at all. Raisins! Wow, okay. Knock yourself out.
Yeah. Parker, still, I mean, in spite of the fact that a lot of cultures need the women to perform certain roles because they're not rich like the Saudi culture.
Right.
But there's still a lot of attempt by the dominant culture to control what women learn. I mean, I read the book Reading Lolita in Tehran.
Right.
And the attempt to control and the fear and the danger of learning something different is still very oppressive, is it not? I mean,
yeah, but again, if you say from where right now in the 90s, because Reading Lolita plays a little bit before that, right? When the revolution had just taken hold of Iran. Now in the 90s, the most interesting rereadings of the Quran and the interpretation are coming from Iran. It's very interesting. And there's groups of women who really, in a very creative way, link up with men, because that's the key. You have to link up with men. And produce interpretations that are very novel to Islam. However, Iran is Shiite, so it is mainly it's contained more or less in Iran, but it is starting to live a life of its own. And you have, because in Iran is a tradition of women teaching each other the Quran at home. So in those houses, in those homes, new ideas are brewing. And at the moment the government changes, we can have a new revolution there, but in a very different way, you see? So it is the women at first, were very positive and say, oh, wonderful revolution, and now we are our boss of ourselves and America is out. But then when they saw what it really meant in daily life, they reconsidered. They reconsidered. And they realized that the way out is really the Holy Scripture. Quran tradition interpretation. That is our way out, and we have to find some interpreters who can help us with that. And that's what they're doing. There was another question, and it was something I wanted to say as well. Yeah?
I didn't have my hand up before.
I'm not sure who. There was someone else who had their hand up here.
I did, but you answered it.
Oh, okay, I answered it. So then it's you and then you. Yeah?
So, you mentioned earlier Luther pushing out the boundaries in the Reformation era, and I think about how he did that in one really important way, it seems, was learning what average people spoke in their German language and then translating the Bible into that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Gutenberg Press making that popularly available, and the Catechism as well. And so there was this moment of mass availability of the scripture in a accessible form, and I wonder if there was a particular moment when that happened with the Quran.
That will never happen with the Quran. But what does happen with the Quran is that you have armies and armies, growing armies, of popular preachers. Huh. People who simplify the Quran and say you have to look at what is the spirit of the Quran. The spirit of the Quran is, and that's in the Quran too, that men and women, as far as their religious duties are concerned, are equal in the eyes of God. They are equal. And so they both have the same rights and duties, religiously speaking. That's what they highlight. They never speak about BTE. They say, no. Quran is in your heart. Religion of Islam is in your heart. It is your connection with God. That's what it is about. Well, what influence? Do you think sheikhs in Saudi Arabia are like that?
No.
Not a bit. Those people are banned. And they keep making their CDs, and those CDs, you know, they sell like hot buns. They, you know, the more illegal they are, the harder they sell from under the counters in shops all over the Middle East. Because we forget, both men and women in the Middle East and in the Muslim world are very much like us. You know, they like the marriage on an equal footing. This model of I own you, very few people like that nowadays. And I hear a lot of people complain about it. They say, why do women expect so much from me? I would rather have someone who's an equal to me, with whom I can talk. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of changes going on that we didn't have the kind of marriage we have now 100 years ago, right? It was very much more arranged and practicalities. Well, you know, if you had a farm, you both had to work on the farm and so forth and so forth. So in the whole mindset is changing, of course, also because of what comes from here. If you watch Al Jazeera, you all know Al Jazeera, right? And you see these psychological popular talks about marriage and raising kids. Every five sentences, a Western author is quoted. So you see the ideas also, there's this constant exchange of ideas. Well, it seems to be one way right now, but it is changing the whole demographics. It's changing the map. And as I say, that's why Mohammed Atas gets so mad and worried and this and that and everything. He sees that, and then he's staying in Hamburg, and he sees that, well, you know where his mosque in Hamburg is, don't you? You know the quarter. The mosque Mohammed Atta went to was in a building that had four mosques. One was Turkish, sponsored by the Turkish government. One was a mosque packed with mystici. He hates mystici because those say, my heart says, you know, my relation with God. He hated that. Then there wasn't, I think the other one was Somali. And you know what the quarter is where it was? The area of town. Does anybody know?
The red light
district. Huh? The red light district. So that was his frame of reference. He would come out of the mosque totally holy thing, and he would open his eyes and oops, you know, I don't know what he saw, but he saw things. Right? But he felt disturbed his holiness and his pure mind and. So that is what then makes the reaction stronger. You see, this whole thing like seeing all these Germans who have all these freedoms and my God, what's going to happen to Islam when all the Muslims practice these freedoms? You were first and then you. Yeah?
My question is about this honor killing. How rampant is it? Which countries do it? And then who killed these women?
Family. It happens in Saudi Arabia. It happens in Jordan, strange enough, a lot. In Jordan. And it happens a lot in Egypt. And then you find it a lot among immigrants in the West from Moroccan and Turkish origin.
And they don't get punished, or is there a punishment to the parents?
That's the problem. You also see it a lot in Pakistan, by the way. The problem is this, that often the perpetrator goes free. Often there's no jail. And that is one of the most high-profile cases just now in Pakistan, where a girl, I don't know if you read about that case, I think it was a Norwegian girl, she was killed in Pakistan for something she had done in Norway. She was lured back to Pakistan. Obviously, they drugged her, put her in a car, and then the car had an accident, and she died. And the family in Norway did not leave it, and they went all the way to the High Court in Pakistan. And they have opened this case to such an extent that the Pakistanis cannot hide. You know, they have to find who did this to her. And it's probably someone from the family, almost always someone from the family, which is so sad, which makes it so sad.
The father and the brothers.
A brother or a father and uncle. And even there is a case in Palestine of a woman whose husband had died and she was dating someone. Her son killed her for dating someone. And she was like in her 50s. She was not supposed to date, you know. So it is also, I think it also has to do with the family and the honor. That's why it's called honor killing. They feel they lose face. They lose their honor. Yeah?
Is there not also some measure of validity in some of this as a reaction against Western values, which we might even regard as not particularly high level of value? Hollywood and sexploitation, all that stuff. I mean, is it not some authentic validity, not just the reacting?
Well, you know my mantra. There's a dish on every roof in the Muslim world. And what do we send? What do we send?
What
do
you say? There's one
every roof? A dish. A dish.
Satellite.
TV, a satellite dish.
Okay, yeah.
A satellite dish. What do we send them?
Yeah.
We send them violent movies.
Yeah.
We send them awful things. We send them things we don't want to watch.
Yeah.
Often, when the country's a bit poorer, you get the B-rated stuff. Even worse, we send them Dynasty and Dallas and what else is there. I see it's time to stop. Anybody who still has a question, feel free to ask it. But if you want to go, I understand. You were first and then you. Yeah?
My question is if you could go back a minute and talk about what the attraction was for the Iranian women to the revolution.
Oh.
I didn't quite...
Empowerment. Empowerment of being independent. Because the Shah had pushed the button or had pushed the borders too far. He had become too Western.
Uh-huh.
Some women do not want to give up the veil. Some women do not want to give up certain practices. The Shah wanted to make Iran into a European country.
Mm-hmm.
That was too fast,
mm-hmm.
you know, because most of the country is rural.
Mm-hmm.
People are not ready for that. And then there was this idea, we are completely orchestrated by the states. The states
mm-hmm.
dominates us, the United States of America, sorry to say so. That was the dominant feeling. And you know, also because of the military power and so forth and so forth. So that is why when the Shah, it was the Shah that they wanted out. When that regime was overruled, they felt now we have the freedom to develop our own country with Islam. But women didn't know what they were in for. And when then it materialized, they didn't like it anymore, you know, one bit. They very felt, it was, you know, think about it, Nazi Germany. You know that Hitler was hailed with great acclaim
mm-hmm.
in the beginning
mm-hmm.
because people thought he's going to save our place, he's going to help us solve problems, he's going to help us solve the never-ending lack of work and so forth and so forth. You know, if you come at the right time in a part of history, people can have the wrong impression. And very few people realize that Hitler was just plain crazy.
Yeah.
But that's what they later realized. But that was too late.
So by us going in with this war, do you think, from my perspective, it's doing way more harm than good, but how do you feel about
it? Well, I don't have to speak about my own impressions. The whole diplomatic corps of the United States of America was against it. Because a lot of people had lived in the Middle East. If you have lived in the Middle East one day, you know that it will not go down well.
Mm-hmm.
To come as non-Muslim, non-Middle Eastern people and move into that place. It will not go down well. It will not be accepted. You know that. And Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, he said right away, you will wake up hundreds of suicide killers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. That's what happened. Because people will nowadays, you know, people were colonized for too long. They were colonized for till the 50s. They cannot be recolonized. They will not accept it.
Mm-hmm.
They will not. They are just getting over that period. We talked about that last week. How the colonization of countries, you know, ripped the social patterns apart, and then people had to rebuild them again. And what you get, and that is then a breeding ground for extremist ideas, because there are vacuums there that were left by us. So that is the problem. And I was very pessimistic before the war, because I knew we're going to have it. What if we stand on our head, going hunger strike with the whole country? This war is going to happen. You just could feel it. Mm-hmm. Because I was very pessimistic, because I don't know how to get out. Mm-hmm. That's my problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to get out. I have no idea. You know, and without leaving a huge mess and a huge massacre, even worse than we have so far. And, you know, so many Iraqis are dying. And of course, Saddam Hussein was a monster. He should go. He should have gone long ago. They should have taken him out long ago. But this is all in retrospect, you know. But we would have told you the same before it started. Anybody who knows the Middle East would have told you the same.